Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we get a head start on countering the pro-nuclear propaganda film Pandora's Promise, with an interview with Linda Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, who has compiled a stunningly complete report on the lies, disinformation, and spin speak in this hot mess of a fiction that tries to pass itself off as a documentary. Linda and two of her expert sources, plus Numbnuts of the Week and more, will be coming up in just a few minutes. Today is Tuesday, October 22nd, 2013, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. Here's the ongoing radiation report out of Fukushima, and the word just keeps getting worse. On Thursday, October 17, radiation levels had spiked some 6,500 times higher overnight at a well on the Fukushima Daiichi property. Friday's alert said that the contaminated well was at 400,000 becquerels per liter, a record high measurement. TEPCO said on Monday, October 20th, that radioactive material may have flowed into the Pacific Ocean after barriers around the contaminated water storage tanks overflowed following a heavy downpour. Radioactive strontium-90 measured at as many as 70 times, that's 70 times, the regulatory limit of 10 becquerels per liter. The latest mishap at Fukushima comes one day after the utility said radiation levels had spiked well above the regulatory limit at numerous sites following Typhoon Wipa. On Sunday, the barriers around the plant meant to stop radiation leaks acted as dams to trap the rainwater into ponds. Water levels in 11 of those ponds rose high enough to spill over the barriers, TEPCO said. And some of the spilled water may have flowed down a drainage ditch into the Pacific outside the plant's artificial harbor. After the rain, TEPCO said it tested water in the ponds that overflowed and found that a half dozen were contaminated with levels of radioactive strontium-90 above the limit of 10 becquerels per liter set by regulators for releasing water into the sea. Radiation levels at the most contaminated sites were 71 times the limit, this according to TEPCO. Releases of strontium are particularly worrisome because it can collect in human bones and teeth and possibly cause leukemia. According to a post on the blog Fukushima Diary by our friend Iori Mochizuki, due to the recent series of typhoons and heavy rains, the dams are nearly full. However, TEPCO can reduce the retained water by only a few centimeters per day. TEPCO couldn't clear the rainwater caused by the previous typhoon before the heavy rain over the weekend, and they may repeat the same accident with the next two typhoons, which are scheduled to hit Japan this week. Even TEPCO stated the situation is very severe, but have no countermeasures in place. Crossing your fingers and apologizing does not constitute a plan of action. Also from Fukushima Diary, two Fukushima workers commented on Twitter that the previous typhoon, Wipa, caused a slope in the Fukushima plant area to collapse. The slope faces the main street, and the earth and sand that fell blockaded that street. Also, there was a part of the plant said to have had a subsidence. Meanwhile, typhoon number 27 of the season, a record, is expected to hit the Japanese islands next weekend. A TEPCO official said he expected a, quote, tough situation if rainfall from the typhoon is similar in scale to the October 20th downpour. all of which contradicts Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Baby's repeated statements that the situation at the Fukushima plant is under control. The world is weighing in on Japan and TEPCO's management of Fukushima, specifically from Russia, which has had its own experience with nuclear problems from Chernobyl. Igor Yostrisov, an expert in nuclear physics and nuclear power generation, said, "Japan is clearly unable to cope with the situation on its own, so what's needed is an international emergency effort." Vladimir Slivyak, a lecturer at the National Research University's Higher School of Economics in Russia, said, "The company is actually reacting to emergencies as they occur. When something happens, they start considering the situation. In other words, they are absolutely unable to control the situation. Far graver problems may arise at the Fukushima plant than the ones we know of. Friday's jump in radiation levels most likely mean fresh leaks." So what of Prime Minister Abe Baby's reported request for international help? According to Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education, the Japanese government hasn't asked for help. And I don't know whether that's pride or fear that they might find out how bad things really are. Just last week, Prime Minister Abe asked for help, but I've been contacted by three American firms that have gone over and begged to give them their technology, and they've been rebuffed by the Japanese. I really frankly don't believe the Japanese want to have an adequate solution here because they can't afford it. Meanwhile, the Japan Times reports that the Japanese government is trying to reassure consumers that all fish that find their way to market are safe. To bolster that position, the Prime Minister himself, Pinocchio Abe, baby, said from his Facebook page, "Whitefish, horsehair crab, octopus, bleaker's squid. Commercial fishing has finally resumed in Fukushima. I couldn't help but exclaim, oishi, delicious." Naturally, the safety of all of these had already been confirmed through testing. "I am determined to join in communicating this information to the public and to protect fisheries from reputational damage from radiation-related tumors." Rumors. Freudian. That came along with a picture of Abe and his cohorts chowing down on Fukushima fish. Regarding the pending planned removal of the spent fuel rods from spent fuel pool 4 at Fukushima, Mitsuhei Murata, Japan's former ambassador to Switzerland, said, "The unit 4 contains 10 times more cesium-137 than Chernobyl. So in case the worst occurs, a total withdrawal from the site will be imposed, which means that this can be considered as the beginning of the ultimate catastrophe of the world and the planet. The 2.5 years of struggling by the state and by TEPCO have proven that nuclear accidents cannot be coped with by electric companies or by a single state." According to Channel 4 News in the United Kingdom, the World Nuclear Report in 2013 said the operation had the potential to cause, quote, "by far the most serious radiological disaster to date, if it goes wrong." It warns of the possibility of apocalyptic scenarios, including the evacuation of 10 million people in the surrounding area, including Tokyo. "There are 400 tons of irradiated spent fuel from Reactor 4. Whether the fuel assemblies have been damaged, which could lead to radiation leaks if the casings have been breached, has not yet been determined. If the fuel assemblies are dropped, they could lead to a partial meltdown." Nadim Qureshi, an MIT-trained engineer, said, "Nuclear fuel and waste products generated in nuclear reactors remain radioactive from 10,000 to tens of millions of years. When these waste products are released into the environment in an accident, they are there to stay." Michio Ishikawa, president of the Association for Nuclear Decommissioning Study, said, "On a scale of 0 to 10, I'd say the decommissioning process has advanced by 0.1. If specialized robots cannot be designed that can work in the radioactive environment, easing the upper limit on radiation exposure for decontamination workers at the Fukushima No. 1 power plant is going to be essential. Right. Change the number and everything is fine. Not. And to all of this, a TEPCO spokesmodel said, "The removal of the fuels is an experienced technology used everywhere over the world. The risks are evaluated and well under control." She neglected to mention that around the world, it's a computerized system, whereas for TEPCO at Fukushima, it is going to be done manually by a crane. But relax, the operator's going to be able to gauge what he is doing by watching the operation through binoculars. But there are humanitarians in Japan. Dr. Akira Suginoya performed life-saving cancer surgery on more than 100 children after the 1986 Chernobyl catastrophe. Today, as mayor of a central Japanese city, he has offered Fukushima children homes in his town. The Japanese government has detected 44 confirmed and suspected cases of thyroid cancer so far among 217,000 youngsters 18 and under. They were all in Fukushima Prefecture. Thyroid cancer among children is generally rare, estimated at only 1 in 1,000,000. Suginoya said, "A terrible thing has happened, but people don't realize it at all." Which brings us to
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
That's right, it's Num Nuts time. You've heard me talk about lead-lined jockstraps on Nuclear Hot Seat. Well, it's happened. A Japanese company has invented carbon wetsuits and lead-based underwear that they say can protect against radiation. Osaka-based swimwear company Yamamoto Corporation unveiled the anti-radiation garments on Thursday, October 17. The company claims that the wetsuit, made from stretchy rubberized kneaded carbon, can stop 100% of beta radiation. Scheduled to be released in November, the wetsuit will cost just over $1,000, while the underwear will cost around $825. Not a bad price if you want to preserve your cojones or your ovaries. It does come in women's sizes, doesn't it?
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Here in the United States, there's a battle for belief, and the U.S. government is not helping whatsoever. As though we expected they would. The public is expressing concern over radionuclides riding the Pacific Ocean currents that are forecast to reach Southern California sometime between 2014 and 2016. But when faced with projections of the radioactive plume hitting the West Coast, the EPA says no comment. The FDA will not test the fish. Our tax dollars at work. Citizens are up in arms, especially here in California, where they are begging officials to act and getting nothing. A typical response comes from local officials in the coastal city of San Luis Obispo in California. They said that they are not concerned about a radioactive plume, though they admittedly rely heavily on the federal government for information to support that opinion. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration referred all questions on radiation to the EPA. The EPA says that it's working closely with the NOAA. But none of you are saying anything to the citizens who are begging for the information. Spokesmodel Ernesta Jones said, "To this day, the RadNet system continues to confirm that there are no harmful levels of radiation in the air reaching the U.S. from Japan." What she neglected to say is that the RadNet system was seriously broken at the time of Fukushima, and we still don't know whether all of those broken radiation monitors have been fixed. Tra-la, tra-la. Moving right along, a leak was found in a nuclear reactor at the Palo Verde power plant near Phoenix last week. According to the American Society of Clinical Oncology,
Cancer is now the leading cause of childhood death in the United States. According to the American Cancer Institute, one out of every 300 boys and one out of every 333 girls will develop cancer before their 20th birthday. While Japan pretends that the fish is okay and neither the EPA or the FDA in America will test, Dr. Alexandra Morton, a biologist, has found pink salmon that are canary yellow on Canada's Pacific coast. It showed up in parts of their hearts, their gill arches, their spines, the cartilage in their heads, all of it yellow. Their spleens were swollen and enlarged, their livers spotted, and in some cases, their eyes were bugged out. Okay, now I really am swearing off lox and bagels. Little bit of international news, none of it good. In India, nuclear power company, the nation's sole atomic energy producer, test started part of the $2.84 billion Kudankulam nuclear reactor amid protests from local residents that delayed the commissioning by 6 years. This is numbnuts, though it didn't win this week. Leaders from four Central European countries have come together to tell the European Union that they feel that nuclear energy is being discriminated against, and they have called for the EU to support their nuclear expansion plans. Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, known as the V4, said in a statement, "We expect the European Union to facilitate the increase of Central Europe's nuclear capacity rather than impede it." The statement cautioned against overregulation of the nuclear industry. What, like safety? From New Zealand's Newcastle Herald comes a terribly upsetting story of an experienced Australian sailor, Ivan McFadden, recounting a recent trip he took across the Pacific Ocean, where he saw no birds, was able to catch almost no fish, saw only one listless whale that seemed to have a tumor on its head, and came to the conclusion, the ocean is broken. It's a heartbreaking eyewitness report of what's happening to the Pacific in the wake of Fukushima. We'll have a link up to this story with a picture on our website, nuclearhotseat.com/blog. Time for this week's interview. We're taking a preemptive strike on the film Pandora's Promise and getting the info to you in advance so that you're well-armed when this thing hits on CNN. My guests this week are Linda Gunter, who serves as Director of Media and Development for Beyond Nuclear. She's joined by John W. Rocco, a medical doctor with a PhD in chemical engineering. He has been on the board of Physicians for Social Responsibility since 2007, is a past president and current treasurer of the organization. M.V. Ramana received his PhD in physics from Boston University and is currently with the Nuclear Futures Laboratory and the Program on Science and Global Security at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Together, these three discussed the lies of Pandora's Promise.
Linda Gunter, John Rocco, and Ramana. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks, Libby. Good to be here.
Yeah, good morning.
First of all, full disclosure, none of us has actually seen the film Pandora's Promise. So how do we know it's propaganda and what makes it propaganda?
Well, Libby, first of all, we have colleagues who have seen it who have given us very detailed report back, so that's been helpful. There have been a number of excerpts and trailers online. And Robert Stone, the director of the film, has been pretty upfront about how this film got put together and has posted a lot of information and his opinions about it. So in my view, the reason it's propaganda is that it started with a premise, and he went out to fulfill that by only talking to people who, quite frankly, have somewhat, in most cases, somewhat scant knowledge of the issue, certainly no depth, only sort of cherry-picked people that he wanted to talk to who would support that point of view. Now, if he had gone out and interviewed people like our other guests on this show and other people with deep, long, truly independent scientific knowledge of this issue and then still concluded that nuclear power was a good idea, that's fair game, that's his opinion, but that's not how this film came about. And therefore, I find it extremely suspect, along with a lot of the rhetoric that's now accompanying the film and supporting and promoting it, which is full of terrible errors of omission and facts that, if they had been included in the film, would have completely torpedoed their point of view. So I feel like it's straight out of Reason. And finally, the fact that they are, you know, bankrupt enough to take tired old cheap shots at individuals and groups that have been on this issue for decades and really do know it inside out and can support their arguments with sound science and yet are just sort of dismissed as emotional, that tells me that if that's the sharpest arrow in their quiver, they don't have a whole lot behind this smokescreen, frankly.
When the movie cites environmentalists who have changed their mind and gone pro-nuclear, what is it that make those quote-unquote environmentalists suspect?
Well, because they're not environmentalists. I mean, you know, I don't see how you can be call yourself an environmentalist if you support an extractive industry that pollutes grounds and, you know, the groundwater and the air and the soil and releases harmful radioactivity and creates radioactive waste that's dangerous for up to millennia. You know, by what definition, if you support an industry like that, are you an environmentalist? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, in keeping with a lot of the rhetoric that surrounds this film, if they say it's so, therefore it is kind of their modus operandi. And to call themselves environmentalists, you know, a couple of them, like Mark Lynas, supports genetically modified food. The Schellenberger, who heads the Breakthrough Institute, which is really behind this, I think, in many ways, is pro-fracking. So I think they've just redefined the word environmentalist to suit what they support. It has absolutely nothing to do with it. And they should really say that they are former environmentalists who now support nuclear power. And that would be a more honest description of what they now espouse.
I'd like to add to that by saying that the primary environmental argument that's been offered for nuclear power in recent years has been the fact that its carbon emissions are low. While that is true, what it does do is to ignore all the other environmental implications that are associated with nuclear power. These are quite well known, but for reiteration, I would say the radioactive waste problem. And the problem is that even if you were to take the point of view that nuclear power is a low-carbon source and should be supported in order to try and find a solution to climate change, the question is it a good solution? And is it a solution that can be workable in a quick period of time, which is what we need in order to get the climate problem under control? And all the evidence suggests that nuclear power just cannot be ramped up as fast as many of these people wish it to be. So in that sense, even if they were environmentalists, they're not really thinking about the environment deeply enough to be able to use this as a solution.
John, you talked about substituting the concept of a convenient lie for an inconvenient truth and talked about the apostasy of the people who are speaking on behalf of the nuclear argument. What did you mean by that?
When you're thinking about someone who has been a strong voice for something, presumably taking a reasoned approach, suddenly turns around and says, I've completely rethought this, I was completely wrong, the opposite is what is true, and I am embracing this fully, that just somehow isn't satisfyingly genuine, but it does attract a lot of attention. There are other aspects of what we're talking about that is curious is that the film apparently purports to utilize technology that is old and has never been able to be made truly functional, let alone anywhere near to commercialization level. And last, they seem to pretend that somehow the spent nuclear fuel problem is just going to vanish with this wonderful new concept. And these are concepts that don't exist in real life. They have to yet be developed. At the very best, they're only on the drawing board, and that it is maybe comparable, possibly, to the goal of achieving energy generation from nuclear fusion, which is always a generation or 30 years or at least decades away before even a good pilot plant can be operating.
And you know what's interesting about that, Libby, also, is that Stone, the director, kind of contradicts himself, because on the one hand, he goes out there and he says, you know, this is all about our deep concern about climate change. You know, this is why we've taken this position, because that's the paramount challenge. And then on the other hand, when he starts to talk about the integral fast reactor, which is the design that they tout in the film, then he says, well, they're several decades away. So on the one hand, he's saying this is such an urgent problem. We can't afford to, you know, mess around with renewables. We've got to go for nuclear because that's our only hope. And on the other hand, he's saying, yes, but the only design that's worth doing is several decades away, which is too late for climate change. And that's been true about the nuclear problem all along. You know, it just, as Ramana just said, you know, it just can't come on in enough time to serve enough of an impact. And even if you look at the MIT study, which is by no means anti-nuclear, they're saying, you know, one every 2 weeks. I mean, even that is just preposterously idealistic, and it's not.
Excuse me, one every 2 weeks refers to?
One new reactor every 2 weeks in order to offset, you know, some amount of carbon, you know, to contribute towards mitigating climate change. But even then, as I recall, it's quite a low amount, 5% or something. So it's not even going to contribute meaningfully to addressing the climate change problem, and it would require the kind of commitment that is completely unrealistic and isn't going to happen. You know, we haven't developed nuclear on that scale since the sort of mid-80s, and that was a very brief period when it was that kind of output, so it's just not feasible. So I think there's sort of, you know, the problem with this film and the propaganda that surrounds it is a lot of empty rhetoric. It's a lot of very, you know, facile sound bites where it sounds very compelling to an uninitiated audience, and a lot of these audiences, you know, are probably uninitiated, and so they're putting their hands up at the end saying, oh, yeah, we agree with you now. But that's because nobody's asking any questions and seeing what's behind this facile soundbite and what can they really back it up. And the reality just isn't there to prove the points they're trying to make.
This is John. Suppose that the path envisioned by this film is followed and that the goal is, say, two decades away before this vision could actually be operationalized. Who is to profit by that process if we divert down that path? Is this an effort that's going to be funded by private entrepreneurs who will bring the research to actual commercial production? Or is it work that must be funded by governments and taxpayers?
Well, undoubtedly, the taxpayers are going to be asked to pay for this, because that's been the only funding that has allowed for the building of any nuclear facilities or the promotion of any nuclear facilities, because venture capitalists won't touch it. Nobody will touch nuclear because they understand what a bad bet it is. What I'd like to do is cover some of the health and medical consequences of nuclear energy that were glossed over by the film. John, do you have any insight on that to share?
Burning in all of our memories is the events of March 2011 at the Fukushima Daiichi reactor in Japan following the earthquake and tsunami, in which four reactors had disasters either by reactor meltdown and or difficulties in the spent fuel pool. And it brought into all of our awareness how much radiation is in spent fuel storage pool, and that that radiation will be with us for hundreds of thousands of years, no matter what we do. And despite the efforts of dreams of those who might think that waste can be transmuted into shorter lives isotopes, that is another process that hasn't been worked out to be financially, let alone commercially feasible. And that makes us turn to our own country in the United States, where we have 100 reactors in 65 different power stations, with all with fuel pools that are essentially 100% filled. And in Fukushima, the fuel pools, spent fuel pools, were only partially filled, much less spent fuel in those pools than we carry here in the United States. We have plenty of the same very old reactors in this country. There are natural disasters in this country that can cause a prolonged station blackout, as in Fukushima, that would, if there was an accident like that in our country, the amount of radiation that could be released from a overheating fuel pool would dwarf Fukushima and Chernobyl. The health implications are obvious. There's a need for immediate evacuation. evacuation of people, save them. Everything is left behind. Their lives are totally disrupted. Suppose 1,000 square miles of Iowa, prime Iowa crop ground was subject to fallout from a melting down fuel pool. The economic loss to that and loss of prime agricultural production would be, the value of that's incalculable. The health of people that are evacuated in terms of disruptions in their lives is incalculable. And the ongoing releases, which would, depending on the winds, go out in all directions, expose populations far and wide to at least low-level radiation, which we know is has an adverse health impact.
On the health front, I would add that what seems to happen with the people involved with this film is sort of this worshipping at the shrine of the United Nations. So anytime the UN is sort of attached to anything, it's gospel truth and it can't be challenged. And I think that's a big mistake. And one reason is that one of the studies that they cite when they try to downplay the health impacts of Chernobyl, and worse still, Fukushima, where they're saying there won't be any, which I, you know, is kind of immoral, I think. But sticking with the Chernobyl piece, they're citing the WHO, the World Health Organization's suspect numbers, which have been completely exposed already by organizations like International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War and others, who looked at their own data and said, well, they're saying 4,000 cancer deaths, but that's not even what's in the research that they use to come up with a number, let alone a likely reasonable number. And they looked only in a very narrow area, not at the entire, you know, not at all the countries that were in fact contaminated by the fallout from Chernobyl. And so it's just not even vaguely credible anymore and has been completely dismissed by serious scientists who are not anti-nuclear, who've done the work. And then on the other extreme, they will point to us and say, well, we're adhering to these numbers that are possibly a million eventual deaths. And we should say that, you know, it shouldn't only be about deaths, as John was saying. You know, it's also about illnesses and suffering and dislocation and so forth. But even if you're just talking about death, I mean, Yablokov was the head of the Russian Academy of Sciences. So I think he knows a little bit more about this issue than the people involved with this film, first of all. So I don't think they're in a position to dismiss him. But even if you decide that that's not the number you like, you've got to look at how the studies were done, who they were done by, who supported them. And the reason that the WHO is a problem is that it's completely in the lap of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has a mandate to promote nuclear power. So why you would empower the IAEA to go and look and see what the medical consequences of an accident are when its whole mandate is to promote that very industry is an obvious conflict. And the WHO is basically gagged. The IAEA can veto anything it doesn't like in a WHO report. So all of that, you know, that's a typical example of this film, is that they'll just pluck that and say, here you go. You know, that's really all that happened. So it's not a big deal, and radiation really doesn't harm you, which even the National Academy of Sciences doesn't agree with. So I think that's one of the big issues, and it's symptomatic of how they operate, which is to pluck one little statistic and say, well, this is what the UN says, so obviously it's true, and everyone else is just fear-mongering.
Nuclear Hot Seat ran an in-depth two-part series on the World Health Organization's unholy alliance with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Its programs 118 and 119, if people want to get into it in-depth, it includes Joe Mangano going over the entire epidemiology that is approved by IAEA and slams down every point as to why it is a false flag in coming up with statistics. What I'd like to do now is switch back to a part of the conversation that we started before with Ramana and ask for any further information on how valid the claims in the film are when it deals with the safety and the economic advantage posed by this new generation of nuclear reactors.
Reactor type that Pandora's Promise promotes are called integral fast reactors. Fast reactors have a very long history. They are reactors where the neutrons are not slowed down, and that's why they're called fast. And these reactors, because they produce a lot of heat in a very small amount of volume, they have to be cooled by some material that can carry away this large amount of heat efficiently. And so the material that's often used is molten sodium. There are other fast reactors which use molten lead as the coolant. there have been lots and lots of reactors that have used molten sodium, and almost all of them have had lots of difficulties, problems with it. In particular, there are basic chemistry problems which have to do with how sodium interacts with air and water. As high school chemistry will tell you, the reactions are one of burning and of explosions in principle. So sodium is not a nice material to use as a coolant, even though it's very efficient. And all the fast reactors that have been operated so far, just about all of them have had numerous leaks, and many of them have had fires associated with them. And so this is one of those things which is not mentioned at all from what we have heard about in this movie. And it's not a problem that's going to go away because it has to do with basic chemistry. It's not a question of engineering it in any better fashion. The second issue with fast reactors is that in normal light water reactors, light water cooled reactors, the reactors that are most prominent around the world, what happens when there is a little bit of a reshuffling of the core because, let's say, a certain part of the core gets overheated and starts melting down or slumping down, is that typically the reactivity goes down. So the reactor produces less heat when this happens. A fast reactor, on the other hand, has the opposite characteristic, that when the materials melt down and come closer to each other, they could in principle increase the reactivity, right? And you could end up with some kind of a positive feedback loop that leads to more energy being produced and that melting the fuel more, the fuel coming closer to each other, and that producing more heat and so on and so forth. And this vicious loop will basically end up in a small nuclear explosion. These are small compared to a nuclear weapon, but nevertheless, in terms of their ability to break through any containment building and so on, they are certainly strong enough to do that. And so this has been a concern with fast reactors ever since the 1950s. In fact, the first person who did this calculation is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist called Hans Bethe in 1956, who looked at how this energy can, in principle, keep increasing and result in explosion. Right? And so fast reactors have these very basic safety problems which have never quite been resolved. You can try to do things to make the reactor safer, but usually when you do that, you end up increasing the cost of the reactor. You have to use either more material or you have to build it in a way that's larger, in which case you're going to require more containment volume and things of that sort. So there are no very easy answers in terms of trying to resolve both the problem of safety and of economics simultaneously.
What are the long-range risks posed by countries jumping into building this new generation of nuclear reactors?
The fast reactors typically use plutonium as a fuel because what they require is the very high concentration of fissile material in the core. So typically they use about 20 to 30% plutonium fuel. Occasionally there are fast reactors which use highly enriched uranium as fuel, with maybe about 50 to 70% enrichment in the uranium-235 component, which is a component that can lead to a nuclear explosion. And so the very fact that you have fast reactors built in any place implies that there has to be some capability to produce the plutonium, to convert the plutonium into the chemical form that is suitable for using in these reactors, for actually fabricating the fuel, for loading the fuel, unloading it, dealing with the spent fuel, and so on and so forth. So there's a very wide range of expertise associated with running these reactors, which can all help with also building nuclear weapons in principle. And of course, the fact that there's a lot of plutonium implies that the material to build nuclear weapons is also going to be there. Now, in principle, all of this is going to be safeguarded. There's going to be an International Atomic Energy Agency that's going to be overseeing, and their inspectors are supposed to be overseeing these processes. But, you know, when you're talking about 10 reactors or 100 reactors, you can sort of think about this being a feasible way of keeping track of all the plutonium. But if you're talking about using nuclear power, especially fast reactors, as a way to try and deal with climate change, you really have to be very confident of the safeguardability of these reactors. And I don't think we have the necessary experience or we don't have money invested in trying to come up with new safeguard procedures which are more reliable. So on the whole, I think if you have a large fleet of nuclear reactors based on this design, I think the chances of nuclear weapons proliferation go up. There's no question about that.
The film offers France up as the shining example of a nuclear success story because the country gets 80% of its energy from nuclear. But what aspects of France's energy policy are glossed over by the film?
Well, almost all of them, because that's the, again, that's the sort of easy soundbite, as if having all your eggs in a nuclear basket is somehow a success story. I mean, obviously, first of all, they have a huge amount of waste. You know, like all countries around the world, they have no solution to the disposition of their waste. They have reprocessed waste, which is a chemical separation process they do at Le Hague, which is an incredibly contaminating process, one of the worst, really, on the whole nuclear fuel chain. So what they've ended up with is a lot of radioactive waste with no place to go, and a lot of plutonium, because, of course, even light water reactors produce plutonium as part of the fissioning process. Their dependency has meant that, first of all, there's no meaningful renewable energy program in France at all, so they're completely behind as far as developing renewables go because they've got a state-subsidized industry, nuclear, which has shut it out. They've also got a big problem because in going the nuclear road, they instituted use of electrical heat as well as lighting and so forth. So the bills for the French are very high because they use a tremendous amount of electricity in winter for heat, and so much so that they've had to import electricity from other countries to meet the demand because it cannot be met by their fabulous 80% nuclear dependence. So that's really, you know, not the success story it appears to be. I mean, what Stone says is that their electricity is the cheapest in Europe, but that's just the tariff. It's not what that people actually pay, because they use way more electricity because of electric heat than other people do in other countries. So they've got this sort of lodestone around their neck, which, as Ramana was talking about, has been kind of a bust. I mean, it was an expensive boondoggle in France. Their big breeder didn't go for very long and didn't produce very much electricity. So that's the Super Phoenix. So I think that it's just an idle statistic, this 80%, but it doesn't actually mean anything as soon as you start to really question, well, what has this resulted in?
Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation is fond of saying that every nuclear reactor has a bomb in the basement because the end product, the quote-unquote spent fuel, isn't spent at all. It contains the weapons-grade plutonium, which is then turned into weapons by the military complex. That's an interesting reason why France went after nuclear with such intensity. On the other hand, its neighbor Germany has pledged to eliminate nuclear completely by 2020 and has already made a great start on that. Yet the film cites Germany as an example of a, for lack of a better word, wrong-headed nuclear policy, saying that it is not doing very well with its renewable energy program. What's the truth of it?
Well, it depends how you define well, doesn't it? I mean, if you say that having 25% of your electricity comes from renewable energies, that's not a success as far as Stone's concerned. That's a huge amount compared to a lot of countries around the world. One in 40 households has a solar panel. They have a feed-in tariff with grid parity, which means that if you have a solar panel on your roof, you get to sell that electricity to the grid first. All the renewables get sold to the grid first before anything else can come online. 50% of the renewable energy on the German grid is put there by people like us and not by big corporations. So that's made it a really good business proposition, even for small-scale farmers and others. But it's also really created long-term jobs that have boosted the supply chains as well. So, for example, renewable energy in Germany has created upwards of 380,000 good jobs versus about 30,000 in the nuclear sector before they started to phase out their nuclear power plants. But it's also stimulated and revitalized the steel industry, the ceramic industry, the supply chain in places. For example, if they're doing offshore wind in the Baltic, it's stimulated industries at other parts of the country, not just in those port cities. So that, to me, and I'm curious to know what Ramana will say about India as well, because they, in the film, they also say, well, you know, these big developing countries, their demand for electricity is going to go up, and obviously they should have nuclear plants. But it seems to me, you know, apart from the fact that the Indian's regular population doesn't seem to want nuclear plants, but apart from that, it seems to me that boosting local economies and providing good long-term jobs is something that the renewable energy sector is rather good at and the nuclear power sector is extremely bad at. And therefore, you know, what Germany's doing is not just reducing their CO2 emissions and going all renewables. They're really revitalizing lots of other tangential industries, which is helping their economy, which is the strongest in Europe.
My understanding of one of the things that may be holding up Germany's success in their revolution to alternative locally distributed power generation is that their grid system is not able to keep up with the proliferation of local community sources that Linda was referring to. And that's also a kind of problem that we would face in many developed countries that have depended highly on large point sources of power. Their grid system is designed to manage that and is not designed to manage the distributed power that the alternative solar and wind sources would have to be able to distribute adequately into a grid that does not require a base load.
I think one should remember that there are huge political stakes around Germany's Energiewende, the transformation of the energy project, and this led to much manipulation, misrepresentation of data from there. So, for example, they had a much colder winter in 2012, and therefore there was a little bit of an increase in carbon dioxide emissions, and many of the established interests were quick to say, you know, oh, this is a result of having too many renewables, that carbon dioxide emissions have actually gone up because of use of coal and so on. This is just kind of misrepresentation of what happened. I think that it's fair to say that the transformation of Germany's energy system is still in its early stages, and that while there are some problems with it, it has not thrown up any major roadblocks so far. And the second thing to remember is that some of the problems in Germany come from the fact that it already has a large existing coal-based infrastructure in which there's huge amounts of sunk capital, right? So many of these utilities that have invested in those things have every interest in trying to keep those things running as much as possible and offering resistance to the renewables. So what the fact, one of the issues that they talk about a lot is the fact that renewables are intermittent. What it tells you is that if you're starting from a blank sheet of paper, you would not actually try to build coal plants or nuclear plants or something as the offsetting kind of generation to renewables. What you do are things like gas, which can ramp up and down very quickly. And the second thing you would do is to have infrastructure that allows the transmission of power from different parts of the country or, in fact, the whole continent, so that where when the wind is not blowing in one area, it's blowing elsewhere, and the power can come from there to all the areas. And so if you were thinking about the long-term future and thinking about renewables as being an important part of that, then trying to promote nuclear power is exactly the wrong thing to do. You want to be promoting, and it's not just nuclear, it's any kind of energy source that cannot be ramped up and down quickly. That's what you really need as a complement. All you need is large amounts of storage. And one should be thinking about that and spending money on investing in those kinds of technologies as opposed to baseload technologies.
What are the dangers of this film running unopposed on CNN? And what, if anything, has been done to contact the network and try to get our perspective on as a counter to each showing of the film?
On the second part of the question, what has been done to try and counter the film's airing on CNN? We began a Beyond Nuclear campaign a couple of months ago now, I suppose, once we knew that they had bought the film, to try not to ask them to pull the film, although from the integrity point of view of the network, they should, but they won't. So not to ask for the impossible, but to ask them to schedule on the air after the film shows, preferably, a discussion of what went on in order for bona fide, genuine, independent expert on the subject that the film covers to declare what's true. So what we did, first of all, was ask them, which seemed to be the most straightforward thing, not expecting an answer, and we didn't get one. So both by phone call, letter, and email, nothing happened. Then we began, in association with Physicians for Social Responsibility, an online petition, which gathered about 5,000 plus names, which to CNN is probably not a whole lot, but to us was a pretty good indication that people felt strongly about this, and sent that registered mail to the VP of programming, who's ultimately the person who would make that decision. And, of course, we've been met with a complete wall of silence. What I've observed in the field lately is that where this film has been shown, they have not allowed a dissenting voice on the platform. They'll take questions from the audience, but they've been not permitting the opposing voice to speak on the dais with them, which is an interesting development and I think speaks to their probable concerns about the holes in their arguments. So that's where we've got, but I'll defer on, you know, what kind of impact this is going to have by being aired on CNN.
One of the impacts that this film could have, and it may actually be an intention of the film, is to make just our general population much less circumspect about nuclear power, and to use a little bit of legerdemain to indicate that the solution, the grand solution to our problems, is upon us. It's just around the corner. All we need to do is embrace it. Well, in fact, the solutions that are being proposed are old ideas that have failed to be developed and implemented ever. One of the key parts of this integrated integral fast reactor is the reprocessing part. It is just not widely understood, and that's, I'm sure, going to be minimized in this film. It's not widely understood how complex, messy, toxic the reprocessing process is, in which you extract the plutonium that you want to use for fuel. It essentially takes dry, spent fuel in fuel assemblies and converts that into multiple, extremely reactive liquid waste streams, which are far more difficult to manage and dispose of than the dry, solid, spent fuel that could simply be taken out and buried deep under the ground in a repository. Unfortunately, no one has been able to find or develop an adequate repository other than on a pilot scale anywhere in the world, to my knowledge. So those liquid streams have to go somewhere. They go in huge tanks or, sadly, just get dumped in the ocean.
Linda, you created an extraordinarily thorough report for Beyond Nuclear on this film and the various points that are raised. It's 50-some-odd pages. In it, you contradict every aspect of the issues raised by Pandora's Promise. You've even got the footnotes in there. There's also a two-page summary that's perfect for printing out and handing out at events or at showings or under other circumstances. How can people get their hands on copies of this important anti-Pandora information?
Well, thanks, Libby. And actually, we were gratified to note that when this film was shown in Traverse City, hosted actually by Michael Moore, who appeared to be doing a favor to Robert Stone because Stone launched his career, Robert Stone asked the audience if they had been handed a flyer when they came in and said that they, you know, that we'd been flyering all the screenings. So that was actually good that they've noticed that that's happening. And the two-pager, everything can be actually downloaded and printed off our website. It's www.beyondnuclear.org, but there's a tab at the top called Pandora's False Promises. That's where everything is. So whether you want to go through the long report, which I encourage people to do, and I've got a lot of help from Ramana as well on, you know, on peer reviewing, especially the scientific aspects of this, you can do that or download the two-page flyer. We're happy to mail copies to people who'd rather do it that way. On Pandora's Promise website, they list the upcoming screenings. So if there's one near you, we encourage people to not only leaflet outside, but to go in and ask the questions, because it's not getting challenged. And that's, I think, the most dangerous aspect of the film and the propaganda that surrounds it, is that it just sits there unchallenged. So I would just reiterate that if you have a chance to see the film and you decide that that's how you want to spend your evening, challenge it. Get up, speak up, use the information that's out there. Don't be bought out by the simple sound bites. There's a lot more to the story that they're not telling you, and there's a reason they're not telling you, because it would completely punch holes in pretty much everything they're saying.
That was Linda Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, John Rocco of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dr. Ramana. Thank you so much for being on Nuclear Hot Seat. We will have a link up on the website to Beyond Nuclear, where you can find the 2-page handout, convenient for bringing to any film showing of Pandora's Promise, and a full report on what I call Pandora's Propaganda. Look for the tab at the top labeled Pandora's False Promises. I'll have the radiation protection tip for you in just a moment, but first I want to remind you that Nuclear Hot Seat needs your support. To keep bringing you the anti-nuclear news, there are radiation protection tips, activist opportunities, numbnuts of the week, the NRC duck report, and so much more. So if you'd like to help, go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, stay on the homepage, scroll down, click on the big red donate button. Hey, it's easy. Whatever you can do to help, know that it's appreciated and, quite frankly, necessary. Here's the radiation protection tip. We all know that sea salt is better than that stuff with the girl and the umbrella on the container. But where was your sea salt sourced? And when? Check the labeling. If it comes from the Pacific and did so any time in the past 2.5 years, you might want to consider changing brands. I know I have. And now get my salt from a family-owned business in Utah that mines it from prehistoric deposits 2 miles down in the earth. I even called the company to make certain they weren't contaminating what they brought up with downwinder dust. After some intense grilling of one of the owners, I was convinced that this product is clean, at least for now. And at least the salt is not from the poor, beleaguered Pacific Ocean. Activist shout out, hey, Harvey Wasserman! The petition for global intervention at Fukushima has surpassed 100,000 signatures. So please join, sign on, and spread the word. You can find it at nukefree.org. We will also again have a link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com/blog. A reminder that I'm still looking for contacts to John Stewart because I am the nuclear pundit and the provider of his nuclear punditry for The Daily Show. Any contact, anywhere, if you know someone who can help get John and me together, send your leads to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Our final thought today comes from Mariko Bender, founder of World Network for Saving Children from Radiation, which focuses on the children of Fukushima and what can be done for them. She wrote, "Children in Chernobyl are still sick after 27 years. A group of Fukushima people visited a small village with 1,000 children last year. They were shocked to know that every single child has multiple diseases. We failed Mayak. We failed Chernobyl. We cannot fail Fukushima, because if we fail Fukushima, we will allow this horrible tragedy to happen somewhere else in the world again. The industry and the government have taken advantage of our weakness, and that allowed ugly history to repeat again and again. Can we change? No child has to suffer from sickness caused by radiation. From your mouth to somebody's ears, Mariko Bender, you can find World Network for Saving Children from Radiation on Facebook." Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from ENENews.com, Fukushima Diary and our friend Iori Mochizuki, Arnie Gunderson and Fairwinds Energy Education, NHK, Voice of Russia, RT.com, Japan Times, China's Xinhua, NHK World, Asahi Shimbun, Channel 4 News in the UK, CBS 5 in Phoenix, Phonology.org, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, Alexandra Morton's blog, ABC News, Ecobusiness.com, Voice of America, TEPCO, Shinzo Abe Baby himself, World Nuclear News, AP, Arab News, Nutramedical Report, and a lot of U.S. mainstream media jumping into the stories, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, San Diego Union Tribune, Santa Maria Sun, and not media, but better than media, the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook community. Theme song performed by Marilee Weber. Our archive is available on iTunes or at nuclearhotseat.com/blog. Please comment on our website or at Nuclear Hot Seat on Facebook. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues, so if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Copyright 2013, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but I do allow fair use. You can reuse this material as long as proper attribution of me, the website, and the email address are included. In closing, this is Libby Halevi of Heart History Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we did it with San Onofre, it's still closed, and we'll close all the rest of them as well. Now we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.